Hi, Francine here. We'd like to start this podcast with an acknowledgement of the atrocities being carried out across the United States by police forces, egged on by their government. We hope that anyone who's listened to this podcast already knows our stance on this. Black Lives Matter. We are behind the protesters 100%. Although, of course, this has been going on for decades and centuries, never before has there been such an influx of footage proving the incompetence and malevolence of police forces across the states. Joe and I tried to discuss this in our usual style, but we are two white women in England, and frankly, we decided it was unhelpful and incoherent. So instead, please check the show notes of this episode for a list of resources, which includes ways you can help and where to find black voices speaking about what's actually going on in the States. The hieroglyphs on the top of this, by the way, say the truth shall make you frat.
You made us a hieroglyph logo.
Yeah, I did one of those silly website things. If I have time, I might look into hieroglyphs properly and try and translate it, but I think that's just like phonetically. What?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's literally done letters equal hieroglyphs.
Yes, like no, exactly. Yeah, that's what it's done there. The only one that's a word is the U instead of ye, which is the loop bird, means you.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Loop bird.
Loop bird.
So that's more effort than I've gone to.
I did a lot of reading and just came out with Ancient Egypt is one of those subjects where there is just so much to learn that you can spend hours and still not really come out with anything solid because you just scrape the surface of like a million different subjects, which is kind of what
happened. It's also hard to imagine the concept of how much time it spans. We talked about this like a few episodes ago. You've got a book that talks about all the things in history that happen concurrent with each other. Mm-hmm. And there's things like Cleopatra was alive closer to now than to the early days of ancient Egypt.
Yeah, that's the famous one, isn't it?
And like woolly mammoths were still around when the pyramids were being built and stuff. Like, I know they weren't in the same place, but I can't help but picture woolly mammoths like wandering around sniffing at pyramids.
Oh, I like that idea. It'd be so hot though, poor mammoths.
Oh yes, maybe just a little holiday and then they can go back to the nice icy places.
Mammoths in sun hats.
That mental image has brought me a lot of joy.
But yeah, it's mental. So it's 5,000 years ago, the early, and you know, this is before you start even going into the prehistory time. But yeah, I think from the, do you know, I just read all of this. I just read it, and I can't tell you what bloody time period is called. What?
I have no head for remembering time periods and dates. If it's not written down in front of me, I do not know it.
But it's just that I know obviously it changed a lot, but considering it was that kind of time span, the fact that there was any cultural carryover from the beginning to the end is just astonishing.
And weirdly fascinating.
Yeah. I feel like there must be countless books on how exactly that happened and what the unique circumstances of that region. And
there are so many rabbit holes you can go down, which, instead of doing that, do you want to make a podcast?
Yeah, let's do that instead, because I've only got like a couple hours.
Right, okay.
Introduce us.
Well, I'm Joanna. I'm sorry. Hello and welcome to The Truth Shall Make You Frat, a podcast in which we are reading and recapping every book in Terry Pratchett's Discworld series, one at a time, in chronological order. I'm Joanna Hagen-Young.
And I'm Francine Carroll.
And today starts our discussion of Pyramids.
Pyramids.
Seventh
Discworld novel. The first standalone novel, published 1989, and it won the 1989 British Science Fiction Association Award.
That's nice for it.
Yes, it is.
Considering it's not science fiction.
Yeah, it's also our third book we're doing remotely on this new format.
Yeah, someone pointed out on my work Zoom call that it's been 10 weeks, and I looked at what I've achieved in 10 weeks and felt some shame.
I have learned how to paint, and I've been doing perspective drawings the last couple of days, like 2, 3, and 5 point perspective.
Nice.
5 point perspective is like convex, which is pretty cool.
It is trippy. I'd studied perspective drawing a long time ago. I'd like to get back into doing it, but yeah, I've done a bit of writing, but not as much as I would like. I've generally not been in contact with all the theatre stuff, which I need to start. I did like a fun little theatre Zoom call last week. Okay. We read some of King John, and then we talked about ideas and things a bit, which was nice.
You got a great new haircut
that I gave myself. Learned to cook a couple more things. Added to my repertoire.
Susan was born.
Susan is still alive. Susan got cloned due to my oven breaking. That was a whole thing.
Oh.
So I had 2 jars of starter on the go for a few days.
Are they back together now?
Sort of.
Oh.
And one is going into bread today and not keeping the rest of. And then the other one I'm keeping alive and fed to make focaccia for the weekend.
This all sounds very cruel and unusual. I should stop allowing you to personify things you're going to cook.
I named all my herb plants and I rip them up on a regular basis.
Yeah. Cool. So Pyramids is, I'm liking it. Gina, we always end up saying this. I'm liking this a lot more than I thought it would.
Yeah.
I think I'm rereading this for the first time as maybe not as an adult, but as an adult who knows a fair bit about mythology and more of the references. And
yeah, I think this is probably only the third time I've read this one. It's always been one where I've been like not fussed about going back to it.
Mm-hmm.
You said the first standalone one, like to clarify, obviously, because we are spoiler light. In fact, yes, I should probably do a note on spoilers.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Launched into note it without spoilers. Giving anybody any warnings.
Note on spoilers. We are a spoiler light podcast. Obviously, heavy spoilers for the book we're on, Pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
But we will avoid spoiling any major future events in the Discworld series. And we are saving any and all discussion of the final Discworld book, The Shepherd's Crown, until we get there. So you, dear listeners, can come on the journey with us.
I'm just going to say now, I don't believe calling something a standalone book is a spoiler, and I will not be sticking to that concept.
You just reminded me that I needed to do a standalone.
Oh, I see.
That I needed to do a spoiler warning. By a standalone book, we just mean it doesn't fit into any bigger story arcs, whereas...
Yeah, it's not like so The Witches far. Or The Guards or Rincewind or... Yeah.
Yeah. The ones we've done so far, there are arcs over multiple books, which is exciting. But yeah, so this is the first standalone one. We still haven't had a book where we don't go to Ankh-Morpork, for those keeping track.
Cool. Do you want to summarise what's happened in this first section? Oh, no, we should say what the first section is first, because this is a weirdly organised book, isn't it? There are 4 books within the book, and we're doing just the first one for this section. Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah.
So apologies to the person who asked me on Twitter, because at the time they asked me, I hadn't started planning, so I said we'd go a bit further in, but no, we're just doing book 1 today, book 2 next week, and then book 3 and 4 the week after.
People asking us things. They're engaging.
I know.
That's a good sign.
I know, it's really exciting. It's fun. So yes, in this first book within a book.
Book within a book.
The Book of Going Forth opens on Great Artuin swimming majestically through space. We zoom in on the pyramids in the ancient Valley of the Gel, firing quietly into space. The High Priest Dios begins the rituals of the day as Tepic dresses, preparing for his evening before climbing out of a window. The greatest mathematician on the disc eats his lunch for supper. We see the beginnings of Tepic's assassin's exam and gasp as he plummets towards certain pavement. Flashback to Tepic leaving his home in the Valley of the Gel for the Assassin's Guild in Ankh-Morpork. As he continues falling, we flashback to his arrival at the guild and the history of his education. As we... in real time, watch Tepic grab a windowsill above a bakery and he continues to reminisce. In flashback, he settles into the guild and we get a handy bit of exposition about his kingdom being slightly in debt due to pyramids. Tepic's assassin's exam continues as he spends in flashback his first night in the dorm and meets a couple of new religions. In the next flashback, he gets some assassin lessons from Merisit, and during his exam, he faces off against a potential victim and realises he can't strike the killing blow. As in flashback, he learns about the founding of the Assassin's Guild, Tepic fails at failing his assassin's exam. He heads out on the piss with the lads for some risky fish, and we have one last educational flashback. We watch the sunrise with King Tepic-Imon, the 27th.
Well done. As he good fails. Roman numerals.
Yep. Especially good as I did that from memory and didn't put them in the summary.
Oh, very good.
As he fails to fly.
Well, the some of them.
Yeah. The assassin's lads get a little bit attacked. King Tepekimon has a disappointing chat with a non-scarab beetle Death and learns he's got to hang about in ghostly form until his pyramid's ready, discovers that with the loss of his corporeal form, he can now think clearly. A seagull visits Tipsy Tepek as Dios contemplates Death and deities. The dead king, Tepek starts manifesting some powers, somehow becomes a god and also dead, with a bit of comedy Latin and a walrus on the side. The dead king watches Dylan Gunn start his embalming process and Tepek heads home.
Yep. Dill is apparently a pun.
Oh, is it?
Pickle.
Oh, I did not get that.
Yeah, yeah. I came across that by accident while I was on the forums.
I feel I need to point out now that obviously one of the main locations of this book is the kingdom of Jelly Baby. And on my first read through, I didn't pick up on that at all. I think on my earliest read of this, I just looked at that word and went, I'm not going to think about how to produce it. It's got too many consonants.
Yeah, I've always found that quite easy in books, and it has been to my detriment when I then try and say the words later.
I will just ignore words that look difficult, and then I will miss jokes like Jelly Baby. On to helicopter and loincloth watch.
Mm.
I have to issue a formal apology that in Weird Sisters, I did miss an actual quote. And there was the troglodyte wanderer, a rather faded monkey man in a furry loincloth.
Not even an implied loincloth.
A literal loincloth, and I missed it. Thank you to Victoria in Melbourne for getting in touch and pointing that out to me in the voice of RP Tyler, because it was an excellent email.
Victoria in Melbourne and Victoria, the Russian doll yes. of listeners.
Thank you, Victoria in Melbourne and Victoria, for pointing that out. I am deeply, deeply, deeply sorry. And it won't happen again.
And I'm pretty happy. And also, Joanna's ridiculous corner has been highlighted for what it is.
Okay. It has been highlighted for what it is, but there was a loincloth, which means it's worth keeping helicopter and loincloth watch.
I don't have the time to go into why that's wrong, but okay.
That means I'm right.
Okay, okay. That's fine.
Look, I need a win today. Let me have this.
What's your favourite quote, Joanna?
My favourite, I've done a very short one, and that is to make up for the fact that I cannot promise that in a later part of this book, I will not have a favourite quote that's 2 pages long.
Yeah.
This is page 21 in my copy, so I'm on the Corgi paperback. Francine has a fun little hardback version.
Yeah, my page numbers do not correspond.
It's a quote from Tepek's mother. People never learn anything in this place, she'd said. They only remember things. Which yeah. I just... deep. Like, because it's the first hints of this whole concept of the book and Jell being a sort of stagnant country.
Yeah, it kind of reflects Pratchett's general view on education as well. I think he's always been very against the just learning things, like learning lines, learning dates and whatever. It's not an education, it's a learning your lines.
This was something that used to really upset me in primary school to the point where I am still bitter about it. Mm. We'd have to do these speed multiplication tests.
Mm.
And there were like ranks you'd go up in. Like if you got full marks for a certain number of weeks, you'd get the harder ones and the harder ones. And I got stuck in the bottom rank because I couldn't just memorize a set of multiplications and then look at 3 times 10 and go 30. I'd have to do each sum in my head rather than just having memorized the corresponding things, which meant I could never do it in a short time because I was doing each sum rather than just, I have learned by rote this times table. Anyway, what's your favorite quote, Francine?
Mine's super short as well. It is in the poisons class and the teacher, what's her ladyship's name? My apologies.
Tamalia.
Lady Tamalia says, truly, the world is the mollusk of your choice.
That is a lovely line.
Which, of course, means the world is your oyster. But the world is the mollusk of your choice is possibly my most quoted line from Pratchett. And it faces stiff competition. But so we can launch straight into the characters.
We meet a lot of characters in this book. Because it's the first section. Mm-hmm. Which is where we tend to meet all the characters. Let's start with
Let's start at the very beginning. A very good place to start.
Oh, God, no.
When you read, you begin with P-T-E, apparently. Let's go.
Hey. I'm just clarifying now that if anyone's name starts with a P, I'm treating it as silent. So Tepic is Tepic. When we meet mm-hmm. Tracy, she'll be Tracy. Mm-hmm. King Ptepikimon.
I'm pretty sure it's based on the Ptolemies, which is a T. So,
yeah.
Pronounced as a T, rather. Yeah.
Yeah. We're ignoring all silent Ps and some loud ones, which is going to be really, really difficult when we get to the hippopotami.
I did love the line of, and legend has it, if Ankh-Morpork is ever threatened, they will run away.
So Tepic, mm-hmm. or Ptepic, as... if you fancy. He is introduced as he's dressing for his assassin's exam. Mm-hmm. So he's had this, I like the little line about him having a headache all day and that paying off later.
Yeah.
But, you know, the outfit, all of the weapons, and it's a nice callback to Weird Sisters when we were talking about how, like, so much of Granny and Magret's characters are summed up by how they dress to go to the castle and rescue Nanny.
Yeah.
There's the quiet ceremony of Nanny and of Granny and her hat pins, and there's Magret's decision to put a bread knife in her boot, and it's feels like a callback to that here, where
and this is a lot about confident young man who at the same time is massively over preparing,
which I think is a nice little summation of his character.
I like Tepic.
He's quite a sweet little hero, actually. He's, for someone who he's described as sort of education has settled on him like dandruff, like he's curious and he looks into a lot of things. He could easily be written as an overconfident dickhead, and he's not. He's allowed to be wrong about things.
Well, to me, that is more the mark of somebody who kind of grew up that way with like a million different influences instead of told this is
how things are.
Although it's obviously in the main thing he is told how this is how things are, but he seems to accept that it's not quite quickly when he gets there. And he's like, sorry, I recognise you're ignorant of protocol, but you really should put your forehead to the ground when you address me. So.
Yeah, he gets that brief moment of kingly arrogance when he arrives at the Assassin's Guild and then is corrected and is just like, oh, okay, right, not being worshipped here, crack on. Yeah. There's a brief intro early on to Dios, the High Priest, but we get a bit more about him later. And I'm going to talk about him a lot more in the next couple of sections because there's a good comparison to Grand Viziers in a later section.
Yeah, he is probably comparable to some actual viziers in Egyptian history as well.
I mean, he's sort of, at least in this first section, he's sort of set up as the intelligence behind the throne and the one who actually does things, while the king thinks he's a seagull.
Dios, of course, meaning God in Spanish.
I like where he's described as not a bearing in mind he's the first minister and high priest, wasn't a naturally religious man. It wasn't a desirable quality in a high priest. It made you unsound. Start believing in things and the whole business became a farce. And this idea that he is much more focused on ritual than on actual belief in the gods.
Yeah, and a lot of that comes back in Small Gods.
I feel like this book is...
Yeah.
A lot of ideas in this book really, really develop in Small Gods. This is like a... starting to play with the ideas that Small Gods does in a much bigger way.
Yeah, definitely. But I quite like that this is more contained in a way.
Our Taylor, Tepic's mother, I wanted to just highlight. She's the one who says people never learn anything in this place, they only remember things. She's not from within the kingdom. She didn't like pyramids. She's the one who insists that Tepic goes to school outside of the kingdom. She actually liked cats as well as venerating them, which I thought was a very sweet little detail. But also, like, there's a hint of Disney to that. He starts off the book with a dead mother and a dead father.
The mother unfortunately went for a swim in what turned out to be a crocodile.
Tragic.
But yeah, she's an interesting one. I didn't, and I should have done, looked into whether she has a direct parallel, but that is a story you hear a lot of, having basically a princess shipped in to marry a prince or a king in a country they have no connection with and are just expected to then take it on as their native country, and often just do not and are disliked for it.
Yep. and also install a bit of funny ideas in a son before dying tragically young, or while the son is tragically young. So you've got to kill him off. Anyway, moving on from dead parents, we meet Tepic's lovely school friends, Chidda, Arthur, and Cheese Wright. R.I.P. Cheese Wright. He doesn't make it through the assassin's exam.
That's pretty casual death for Cheese Wright there.
It is, but I think it's something the book does quite well, as it establishes like how cutthroat the assassin's business is. Yeah. I'm really sorry I said that. And that these kids have all sort of grown up with acknowledging that not all of their number are going to make it.
Yeah, because they've had 7 years to get used to the idea, haven't they? I'm sure they would have been horrified the first time they heard it.
But I think I've got a bit of a soft spot for Arthur, the scholarship kid who starts off really nervous, trying to sacrifice a goat in his bedroom, and then turns out to stay on for post-grad work because he's a particularly talented assassin. I just really enjoyed that whole sequence of the he's bringing the goat in and very calmly sacrificing it. And no one's like, why are you sacrificing a goat? It's just, oh, you stupid little kids, and your prayers before bedtime. Yeah. You then get a few more religious scuffles of one of them trying to sacrifice like someone else in a wicker basket.
Shyly putting them in a wicker basket.
One of them asking if anyone sort of liked mind having their intestines wound around a tree. A little war breaking out between one who worships the mother goddess in her aspect of the moon and those who worshipped her in the aspect of huge fat women with enormous buttocks. And the masters intervene and ask them all to calm down the religion a bit. But I like the fact that's happening against the background of Tepic, who's sort of like, well, yeah, no, I mean, my dad's technically a god.
Yeah. I also liked how Arthur and Tepic could be perfectly comfortable with the idea that both of these religions were true. And I'll get my god to talk to your god about not coming and killing you in the night. All right. Cool. Yeah.
That was very sweet. And yeah, I like Chidda's as well. I like having this character who's very confident and seems to know everything.
Yeah.
From a family of smugglers who's not a dick with it.
Yeah, it's one of those characters who is actually confident, not arrogant. They're apparently based fairly heavily on Tom Brown's School Days, which is a kind of Victorian classic, not very widely read nowadays, but something Terry Pratchett liked, and it's kind of the whole boarding school bit is a bit of an homage to that.
I've never read those. Maybe I should at some point.
Like the reference of not going up to what's his chops's name for toast is because there's a scene in that about being the main character like being burnt in front of a fire on purpose by the older boys.
I was so desperate to go to boarding school when I was a kid because I read like the Enid Blyton and Mallory Towers books, and
yeah, exactly. And it turns out apparently not very much like that.
Yeah, no, I would have very much struggled.
My mum went to boarding school.
How did she?
Yeah, military brat, but she loved it, actually. I really wanted to go. I'm not sure I would have done quite as well because I was not as socially apt as my mum was.
Yeah, I was incredibly awkward socially as a child, and boarding school would have either knocked that out of me very quickly or I would have been horrifically bullied for years.
While we're on the subject of the boarding school, but it's this is quite a nice mix of kind of the romanticized chaps all growing up together and having a thing, and the kind of reality of it's a little bit horrible. Further reading for people interested in the often depressing culture of posh English boarding schools, which continues to a certain extent to this day, but at least with not so much corporal punishment. Moab Is My Washpot, Stephen Fry's first memoir.
Oh yes, that's a good one.
Is a very good look into that. Lady Tamale?
Yeah, and she's not a major character. She's just someone they have a lesson with political expediency.
Uh-huh.
But I really, really liked her description. Also, a shout out to Fantasy Name, Random Apostrophe. We haven't had one of those for a while. She was stunningly beautiful, but with the kind of calculated beauty that is achieved by a team of skilled artists, manicurists, plasterers, corsetiers, and dressmakers, and 3 hours solid work every morning. When she walked, there was a faint squeak of whalebone under incredible stress. And I really, really enjoyed that description and just found her rather entertaining.
Yeah, and obviously she's kind of put this appearance together very carefully to be the distraction from what she's actually doing.
Which is poisoning people.
Yeah, and I imagine like the kind of verbose, difficult to follow way she explains things is another facet of that.
Yeah, she's talking, and there's a nice line about the boys learn to watch her hands, not the rest of her, because that's where the poison is. We also have a quick lesson with Dr. Cruce's head tutor later on, which I just wanted to flag, because at the moment Dr. Cruce is head tutor, but he becomes head of the entire guild in a later book. I thought it was quite nice to notice that the name turns up this early, and he's the one talking about the sanctity of life, and that's why they charge so much to do it, and why they only kill for money.
Mm.
Which is a very weird way to look at the sanctity of life, but it's quite sweet in its own way.
Yeah, I the whole way the assassins are portrayed, and that bit in particular. Actually, do you know, no, I'll come back to that. So King
Tepekimon the 27th.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. I like him a lot. Seagull King.
Yeah, he's quite sweet. I like the fact that the book does acknowledge that it's quite stressful to think everyone thinks you make the sun come up every day.
Yeah, especially if you don't know how you're doing it.
It's a bit depressing, really, because he sort of jumps out of a window a little bit thinking he's a seagull.
Yeah, it's interesting. Obviously, this whole book is like scattered with ancient Egypt references and parallels. Tepic and Tepekimon, I imagine, are like based off the Ptolemies, of whom there are eventually 15. And the whole seagull thing, like, so the Bennu bird was like a heron, but a mythological bird, the possible source of the phoenix myth, interestingly, but it kind of represented the soul of the sun god Re, and like the pharaohs were also kind of incarnations of sun gods, and the heron was also kind of like a resurrection symbol, and I'm guessing like the whole seagull thing is just like a funny play on the birds being the resurrection birds, and the because then a seagull comes and passes on his kind of godly soul bit to his son, and so like seagull
that makes sense.
Is phoenix in this part.
That makes sense. He has a lovely little conversation with death. I say lovely, I mean he's dead, that's a bit depressing, but it's nice to see death, nice to know he's everywhere.
Briefly going back, like, did you find it, I don't know, like reading about his madness was quite troubling in a way, like the whole like
it was very dark,
like the roar of the sea in his ears every morning, and the I found myself like vaguely researching like auditory hallucinations to see if it was a specific one, but I think it was just quite a well-written non-specific madness.
It was a very dark moment, and like, don't get me wrong, Pratchett does dark quite well, but it was a very jarring dark page in what was otherwise quite a light-hearted bit. But then also it kind of came just as Tepic was realizing he couldn't take a life, so it had like quite an interesting parallel.
And death did say that like the part of I keep wanting to call him Ptolemy now, Tepekimon that was a god had flown up into the sun, and like there was this spot on the sun, and the
It was only his earthly body that went,
which, you know, he's pissed off enough about, but
But I like the fact that death has decided he's not going to bother dressing up as whatever's expected, because people wouldn't be happy about it anyway.
Yeah. Look, if you're going to complain when I make an effort, I'm just going to turn up how I want to. Thanks.
He was supposed to appear as a three-headed giant scarab beetle carrying the flail of mercy and the reaping hook of justice, which the king points out he would have to carry in his mandibles. And I just want to shout out mandibles because I really love the word.
Mandibles, strongly implied. The scarab god, by the way, I looked up briefly because like I think it's mentioned here that the scarab god pushing the dung ball of the sun across the sky, and he's kind of portrayed as a man with a scarab head. Wait. But it's not how you think. It's not like a man with the weird head bit of the scarab. It's like
like a man with like an entire beetle for
yeah
a head.
Where his head should be. Yeah, it's super weird, like if you look at the Egyptian photos of it, pictures of it.
Hang on. A scarab beetles and dung beetles the same thing? Because I thought it was a dung beetle put the okay,
I think so. Ooh, let's quickly check that. I'm almost certain.
Because it's the... because there's the... And I'm talking about in the book, not actual Egyptian mythology. There's the three-headed scarab beetle of death, and then there's the dung beetle that puts the sun in the sky, and I don't think they're the same god.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if they're the same beetle. Because dung beetles have, like, those weird mandibles at the front for pushing the sun.
They are a type of scarab beetle.
Ah, that's good to know. Oh, we've managed to get entomology in as well as etymology.
Oh, yay. Entomology-etymology crossover episode.
Oh, my God.
Very exciting for a very specific niche of listeners. Do we have any entomologists listening? If so, please get in touch because I think it's very interesting.
And tell us about beetles because beetles are really fucking cool.
I want a bad thing. Ask me about beetles. I can't answer anything, but I just like the idea of it.
Yes, entomologists listening, please get in touch. We've also got the greatest mathematician alive on the disc and the last one in the Old Kingdom who has his breakfast again and has his supper for lunch.
Yes, hinting really that he is some kind of ruminant. But what is he? Yeah. We'll find out next week. Next week? I want to say next week.
On to locations. Obviously, we've already mentioned that we start in Ankh-Morpork, so we still haven't had a book where we haven't visited Ankh-Morpork. There's a really good description of Ankh-Morpork, though, where the book is complaining about it being too sunny. It was by inclination a city of mists and drips, of slithers and chills, and it sat panting on the crisping plains like a toad on a fire brick.
Ooh.
I said it was a good description. I didn't say it was pleasant. We meet the Assassin's Guild, which has a very chilled out entrance exam, but it's very difficult to get out of. Yeah, we talked about the whole boarding school Assassin's Guild comparisons. Shout out also to the YMRCIGBSA, which I'm now trying to find what that's an acronym for. The Young Men's Reform Cultists of the Ichagod Bell Shamroth Association, which Tefik briefly runs over the roof of. We also learn a bit more about Ankh-Morpork's heraldry, which is the aforementioned hippos. The P's are not going to be silent there because here isn't fun to say. Hippos. I'm excited about the hippos. I'm pleased by the hippos. We learn more in a later book about the details of Ankh-Morpork heraldry, and that's one of my favourite parallels to Roundworld in the Discworld books, is all the stuff about heraldry, because heraldry is fun.
It is, yeah. That's one of those subjects that you can tell Pratchett just went down a rabbit hole. It's like, ooh,
this is cool.
Weird and obscure and full of odd obsessed people. Let's follow it.
But I like also that one of the legends about the founding of Ankh-Morpork is two orphan brothers who built the city were found and suckled by a hippopotamus. Yeah, nice little ancient Rome reference in a book about ancient Egypt.
And do you know which, I meant to look it up but didn't, which myth it's paralleling when it says that the, you know, the statues will awaken if the city is threatened?
I think there's a couple of different ones.
Ah, okay, that would make sense. Do we have some lions that are meant to wake up somewhere?
Not me personally, although I...
Oh, you should get one. They're great.
I hold out hope that if danger ever threatens, Eric the Sparkly Crow, Quoth the Cuddly Raven, and the as yet unnamed diving barn owl will all awaken and squawk at intruders. So the other main location is obviously the Kingdom of Jelly Baby, literally children of the gel, being the river / delta that creates the fertile valleys, etc.
Direct parallel to the Nile, obviously.
There's a nice little description of it. Jelly Baby really was a small, self-centered kingdom. Even its plagues were half-hearted. All self-respecting river kingdoms had vast supernatural plagues, but the best the old kingdom had been able to achieve in the last 100 years was the plague of frog. It was quite a big frog, however. That made me laugh. But so, yeah, so one of the big traditions of Jelly Baby, and this is obviously from ancient Egyptian stuff, that rulers are gods. So I looked up to see if there are other cultures that have treated rulers as gods, apart from ancient Egypt. And I'm not going to do the whole list. I'm not going to lie. Wikipedia ended up being a lot of my research today because I'm good at not going down rabbit holes on there. Whereas,
really?
So yeah.
They make it so easy.
I know, but I knew what I need, which information I needed, okay. Got that and got out again. Whereas if I'd gone on other things. So yeah. So Japan from 660 BC to 1945, there were Shintoists, including government officials, claiming to be divine defendants of the goddess Amaterasu. And Hirohito, the Showa emperor, repudiated the false conception of his divinity in the Humanity Declaration in 1945.
I say.
So these are really long-running beliefs. China, there were claims that rulers were deities in some way up to 1911. there were some ancient Roman emperors who claimed deity status. Obviously, the Dalai Lama, the idea is that they are sacred reincarnations. Mm-hmm. Ancient Inca culture, very similar to ancient Egypt, in believing that their rulers were deities of some form. I don't know what the timeline is with how parallel Inca is to Egypt.
Yeah. I mean, the Church of England is kind of based around the idea that the monarch is a direct line to God.
Yeah. It's divine leader of the church.
Yeah.
And the one below God, whereas like in the Catholic Church, obviously that's the Pope, sort of. It's the big schism between Church of England and Catholicism started with a bit of who is the direct line to God.
It just kept getting worse with all the massacres.
Yeah, lots of those.
I was reading about the Huguenot massacre in France. I was listening about it. Oh, podcast recommendation, Noble Blood. Fantastic.
Ooh,
all kinds of cool.
Is that the Dana Schwartz one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love her. I've only listened to a couple of clips. The weirdest ruler is deity thing I found is Hitler.
Oh, good.
Yeah, yeah. He was genuinely glorified as a deity in propaganda. There were loads of religious aspects to Nazism, which, like, I knew there were some, but I've never really looked into this before. Goebbels stated our Führer is the intermediary between his people and the throne of God, so he held, like, I guess, Church of England quasi-deity status.
Sure.
Apparently the regime genuinely tried to replace religion in Germany with Nazi ideology in a lot of ways. So I just thought, I mean, I don't know if interesting is the word, but this is sort of as like this super ancient belief that silly Egyptians thinking their leaders were gods. But that was happening.
Well, if you can get people believing it, it's a pretty good way to guarantee some loyalty, isn't it? Because it's not like democratically or even hereditary position where you can say, all right, you're shit at it, let's get someone else. Like, if they are a god, you're stuck with them.
Yeah.
Divine unless you're right an Angkor Pork, where I can kind of imagine them kicking out a god, like, no, you are being a shit god, we're getting a new one in.
Yeah, over here, like, they'll just smash up the
crocodile. Yeah.
Who hasn't got any ears?
Hmm.
Do crocodiles, like, I feel like this is a known thing, but like, do crocodiles have ears? Can they hear?
Surely they can. Do they not have, like, ear holes like other reptiles?
We're not doing well on zoology today, Francine.
Well, I wasn't expecting a pop quiz. And crocodiles' heads feature narrow openings that lead to their sophisticated inner ears. When crocodiles fully plunge their bodies into water, these openings promptly shut, thanks to the presence of tiny skin folds.
So Offler is an unusual crocodile by not having ears.
Closable orifices.
On to little bits we liked, then. Shall we talk about synonyms? Shall we talk about synonyms?
Yes, let's talk about synonyms.
Let's talk about deadly synonyms.
I should have said euphemisms rather than synonyms here. Basically, clinical ways of saying murder. So the assassins do this, and this is what I was briefly going to get at earlier. How Terry portrays the assassins here can be seen as kind of in a pretty shallow way, kind of a charming debonair. You know, how the kind of romanticism of assassins that we get. And like the Guild of Assassins is very gentlemanly and stylish and easy to like. I kind of feel like I might be reading too much into it, but he betrays his true feelings on the whole thing by giving them these euphemisms for murder, because what does he use as an example here?
There's inhume, conclude, annul.
Yeah, all of that crap. In Round World, kind of euphemisms for murder are used a lot in the military. Wet work is a term reportedly used by the CIA. Neutralized is one we're probably all familiar with. And terminate with extreme prejudice is an interesting way of saying summary execution.
Yeah, the extreme prejudice bit comes up in this book as well.
Oh, it does, doesn't it? In the context of whatever family, cartel yeah. Chid is part of, yeah.
Yeah.
So terminate with extreme prejudice / summary execution is basically killing somebody without trial.
Yeah.
In some kind of pseudo-official capacity. So it was used in the Vietnam War quite a lot to kill Vietnamese people that they decided weren't doing their American job well enough. Yeah, I'm saying this in not a very amused tone of voice, probably largely because of the events of the last couple of weeks. One I found particularly darkly amusing was when one of the authorities in Washington, D.C., I think it was, were talking about an investigation they were going to open into the fact that they had been using helicopters to intimidate the citizenry, which is an incredible line to be crossing.
Yeah.
And referred to it to them as rotary aviation assets.
I feel like it's a particular, I don't want to say American thing, I think it happens in England as well. There's a describing things in any way other than what they actually are to sound like you're doing something that isn't 100% evil, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's come up a lot in the last couple of weeks, but that was the most blatant example I found of it. Rotary aviation assets instead of helicopters.
Lighter note, little callback to Mort, the reannuals.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's just, actually, I think they're mentioned in Colour of Magic as well.
Yeah, it's already by book 7, actually, we found a lot of recurring references and themes and everything, which is pretty cool. Like, the Guild of Assassins, for a start, has come up in several books already, hasn't it?
Yeah, and I like that we get more of a description of how it works here. But also, like, to kind of counterpoint, yeah, I think Terry Pratchett's true feeling is, like, call a spade is still murder. An Assassin's Guild in any other fantasy series would be some kind of shadowy organization underground. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be effectively a finishing school, a posh boys boarding school.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be a villainous thing, whereas here it is just another thing you can do. You can go to the Assassin's Guild, you can go to the Fool's Guild, or you can go to the Thieves Guild.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he does play with it and stop it from being tropey.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I like the way it's portrayed because it's interesting and vaguely amusing, but I do think he kind of drops in these little tones to say, by the way, we're not like, this is still shit. Yeah,
murder is still murder.
Yeah, legal murder is still murder, yeah. While we're at this point, Joanna, do you want to give us a quick word from our sponsors?
Yes, I will, Francine. Now, Francine, I don't know about you, but I'm often concerned about how to educate my child. Having raised a somewhat fictional Sprog who seems to possess the cold, dead eyes of a killer, I need to make sure my sinister offspring gets the best learning experience one could acquire and make some profit off the terrifying toddler. And I'm sure I'm not the only one. Luckily, the Assassin's Guild of Ankh-Morpork are available for all your schooling needs. They'll teach your nefarious little nipper to exterminate, inhume, eliminate, liquidate, execute, wipe out, take out, smoke, waste, top, wax, scrag, slay, and neutralise in style, all while earning enough to keep you in the manner to which you'd like to become accustomed in your old age. Is it morally dubious? Sure. Will you be swimming in some filthy lucre? Definitely. And who can put a price on a lethal little one's education? Well, the Assassin's Guild can. Now, we at The Truth Shall Make Ye Fret have joined with the Assassin's Guild of Ankh-Morpork to offer you, our lucky listeners, a one-off special deal. Just quote code FRETFULFACILITATE to receive 1 week's free tuition, a special set of commemorative throwing knives while stocks last, and one free disposal on graduation. The Assassin's Guild. We know the cost of living. But yeah. So there's a little line when Tepic is dressing that he's had a headache all day, and then it's finally revealed when they go out to eat afterwards that he had a hangunder, which is grapes, wine made from reannual grapes that grow before the seeds have been planted.
Yeah.
And the hangover comes before you've drunk them. So that made me giggle. And it's just nice to see them called back to you, because that's what Mort's family were growing.
Yes.
You have a note here that just says quack. Is this a visit from the patriarchy duck?
No, it's not a visit from the patriarchy duck. I'm sorry, I keep forgetting to edit him in. It's the new software, you understand. But anyway, it's the doctor.
Mm. That sort of quack. So this is the doctor who suggests some cod Latin and then walrus.
He's managing to say stuff in plain English, then realises, look, if I'm going to be taken seriously as a profession, I've got to start making this incomprehensible.
Yeah.
instead of forehead so hot you could fry an egg on it, he says, pyrocerebrum earth culinaire, which is Terry Pratchett's particular brand of terrible Latin, which I love and is throughout.
Yeah. I was trying to find one of the other, I was about to say lettucey bits I like, Latin-y bits I like.
Mortis portalis attaculatum?
Yeah, that was the one. Which is, Pratchett does cod Latin very well.
Dead as a doornail?
Yep.
Ah.
which I like, the doctor also eventually says, he's probably a walrus, he's caught a walrus, there's a lot of them going around.
Is that meant to be virus?
Probably. Walrus is just another word that's really, really funny. Like porridge. It's just one of those, works as a punchline no matter how you insert it. And I don't recommend inserting a walrus.
I'm not a doctor, but...
probably no walrus insertion.
Not for internal use.
My favourite Pratchett... sorry. My favourite Pratchett cod Latin is fabricate diem punk. It's in a later book, but it make my day punk. Yeah. And I don't know how well it relates to actual Latin because I don't speak actual Latin. There was someone on Twitter offering Latin classes during lockdown, but I realised that I do not need to learn to speak Latin.
No, I feel like I would like to speak Latin because it would make French and Italian and Spanish easier to learn. But at this point,
I'm not learning Latin. I don't know. I've got other things on, Francine.
I have not the time, the inclination, or the breeding.
While the boys are drunk, they are singing a song called A Wizard's Staff. There's a knob on the end. We are not talking about that. Will come up again in a later book in more detail, and we may end up with another musical interlude.
It's another wonderful drinking song along the lines of The Hedgehog Can Never Be Buggered. In, Pratchett occasionally makes up a snippet he feels like putting in there, and I imagine some fans somewhere have written a
There is a full version. Believe me, there is.
Oh, I'm very sorry. You look like a lady who's heard a ukulele recently.
Yes. At some point, it'll make it into the podcast. I just want the listeners to be aware that we've noticed it here, and it will come up again. The wizard staff will come
Your
up again.
Your concerns have been noticed. Life on rails. What the fuck was I on about there?
Fuck knows. I don't even know what page that is in mine.
Oh, that's right, yes. This is after Tepic is feeling a little better after his brief brush with death and then omniscience. Before, his life had been ambling along, bent by circumstance. Now it was clicking along on bright rails.
I like that.
I like that as a snippet, and I like it as a concept. Both because it's clever and because, oh God, I wish. Knowing what you're meant to be doing in life instead of kind of floating vaguely from thing to thing as other things happen in your vicinity. Hey! Gestures vaguely to entire life.
Which is all, you know, a little bit on fire and such.
Mm.
Have you seen some countries getting like literal locust plagues at the moment as well?
No. Are we actually in the end times?
Possibly. Where's Aziraphale and Crowley when you need them?
Oh, that would be nice.
Right, sorry. That got depressing. Lunch maths. We haven't
this
actually
entire
established...
episode is just us trying to sound cheerful. We haven't done like this badly since the first Good Omens attempt. I can't even remember what was wrong with us that time.
Oh, I think an election.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Right. Lunch maths. We haven't learned what ruminant it is yet in the book, although we have already said spoilers for the whole book.
Yeah, it's a camel. I was just browsing Pratchett's input on pyramids on the fan group, the alt.fan.pratchett, whatever it was called. And somebody asked a question, in pyramids, the camel uses 5 minutes to prove something very mathematical. It said something like that any automorphic resonance field contains a semi-infinite number of irresolute prime ideals. Some of it I recognise, but not all. Is that something Mr. T has copied from a random book of mathematics, or is it junk? And Pratchett answered, saying, it could be that I know some maths, others do not. Or it could be that I bought a maths graduate friend a drink and asked him to gibber in math, which he did. What do you think, boys and girls?
Yeah, I might consult with a friend who, like, I'm good at maths in that I can do sums in my head, but I know people who are good at maths, like, they understand that there are actually 12 dimensions.
Yeah.
So I may ask a friend who understands a lot more about maths than I do to translate some of the camel lunch maths, as you have so eloquently described it. Yeah.
That's the kind of maths that, instead of, like, making life easier, makes life harder, because now you know too much about the universe and it's distressing.
Yeah, and that is what scares me about learning physics, is that I will understand so much less about my place in the greater universe, and it's bad enough listening to Infinite Monkey Cage when I try and sleep.
Yeah, my brain, I think, is just not wired to grasp concepts like quantum and higher mathematics and things.
Yeah,
some kind of self-defense mechanism.
I don't have a good head for quantum, and I may consult with someone who has a better head for quantum before next week, because the main concept of this book is a bit difficult.
Yeah, I don't have a good head for quantum in the same way I don't have a good head for heights. I get dizzy and distressed when it's placed in front of me, and I feel like it's for an evolutionary reason. Flashbacks is a storytelling technique, Joanna. This is something you'll know more about than I do.
It's different for Pratchett to tell a story in this way. A, splitting the book up into the small books, which hasn't happened since Colour of Magic.
And is kind of done in a different way here, because it's not like four novellas.
Yeah, Colour of Magic was four stories. This is one book, but broken up nicely into four section things with some little time jumps between and what have you.
Yeah.
Using the whole flashback structure in the first section, so as Tepic's going through his assassination exam, you get all these different flashbacks. That's not something I noticed in any other Discworld novels.
No.
But the whole theme of the book is kind of being stuck in the past and not allowing growth and change. And I thought it was quite a nice reflection of that theme, that you have all these flashbacks to how he got to where he is at the beginning. And there is this whole idea of that's the only stuff he's got.
Yeah.
That allows him to break the kind of horrible stagnant cycle of the kingdom in the later book. I don't know if what I'm saying is making sense or not. By letting the writing linger in the past in the first section, that allows Tepic to break free from lingering in the past of Jell in the later three sections.
Yes, I think I get what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of. Yes.
So anyway, I thought that was fun. I found it interesting. On to the actual assassination itself, which we've already talked about a lot. I was looking at the section where he's doing his exam and he's kind of listing all the different things he could do, etc. So there's things like the priests, which were the reinforced overshoes, and the poisons and crossbow bolts and caltraps and things. Yep. I was trying to research more about these techniques and methods and stuff. So if anyone looks at my search history, I look great. The problem is that trying to look this stuff up, I mostly was finding like how to spec out your assassin rogue in this RPG.
I looked it up for you in my Victorian encyclopedia. Yeah, weirdly, even that was talking about World of Warcraft.
I would have had Victorians as more of a Guild Wars type.
Minecraft. RuneScape is the early.
Yeah. We can name MMORPGs. Look at us. What
Did
I'm really
RuneScape
annoyed about.
World of Warcraft come first?
The chicken.
Cool. Yep. What are you annoyed about?
Oh, well, so I just finished playing Dragon Age 2 and I was playing a rogue with an assassin build, and I'm very annoyed that I found a lot of stuff about how to spec out my character having completed the game last night.
Yeah, nice.
But in researching assassination techniques, I did find a couple of interesting bits, one of which is that in the Eastern Roman Empire around the time of the Middle Ages, a very popular assassination technique was strangling someone in the bath.
Dignified.
Yeah. And the first heads of government to be assassinated with a firearm were James Stuart, 1st Earl of Moray, the Regent of Scotland, in 1570.
Very good. That is early. Was that a musket?
There were firearms in the late 1500s. There were pistols.
Oh, were there? Okay. I've got all my centuries mixed up. Never mind.
Yeah, this is 16th century. Took me a second. I'm so bad at way around the numbers go.
I know which way it goes, because if you think about it, we're now in the 21st century and our thing is 20.
Yeah.
But it always takes me manually remembering that. And then
I have to go through that whole process.
Yeah. It's like you still sing the alphabet song when I'm putting a book away.
Oh yeah, me too. Very much
A, B,
so.
C, D, there we go.
I either sing the alphabet song or picture the like the letters on a keypad, like on a Nokia 3310.
Oh, smart. I like it.
Like, I'd have to press 9 3 4 times to get this S.
That is such a millennial-specific way of doing things.
It is. Moving swiftly on, I did have a quick look at like the background of assassination as a political tool and what have you as well. One interesting thing I found is that the earliest known use of the assassinate as a verb was 1600, 5 years before it was used in Macbeth, callback to last week, by Matthew Sutcliffe in a brief reply to a certain odious and slanderous libel lately published by a seditious Jesuit.
I really wish people titled essays and books in the way they used to. I love insanely long titles.
There is so much to know there. I mean, it's what back then is to ridiculous headline writing is now.
Yeah, clickbait.
This is one of the main things, stupid tiny thing I've missed in lockdown is the fact that at the moment, or it used to be, my walk to work would take me past the local newspaper office, which should always have a little A board outside with truncated headlines on. And there's something about looking at this piece of paper on a little A board out of context would make these things fucking hilarious. But yeah, assassination for military purposes, even Sun Tzu was suggesting that back in 500 BC. So not the oldest profession, but one of them.
I'm sure there is absolutely never, ever going to be any way to know, but I would like to know which came first.
What, assassination or prostitution?
Yeah.
The egg.
Yes, that's it. Chicken came before RuneScape, but the egg came before assassination.
Should we round out with some other parallels to ancient Egypt then?
Sure.
Not the prostitution and assassination, I mean.
Yeah. Tepic's mother, he just makes sure that the river floods every year, do you see, and services the great cow of the arch of the sky. My mother explained Tepic, which I think is referencing Nut, who was the god of the sky, stars, cosmos, mothers, astronomy, and the universe in ancient Egypt. And she was depicted as often a star-coloured nude woman arching over the earth, which, by the way, is my new aesthetic. Or as a cow, which is my other aesthetic, depending on the day.
I didn't realise that was based on an actual thing, but there's another reference to a nude star-covered woman in which I was going to look up in a later section of the book. So now I don't have to.
Ah, cool. What was another one? Oh, this is possibly a little bit tenuous. The wheat growing from the bread when Tepic is doing his spring god thing. Osiris, you know the story of Osiris? He was kind of killed and resurrected as god, he was depicted with wheat growing from his body, which was a symbol of resurrection. We're saying we're getting a lot of resurrection symbols in this part of the book.
Resurrection, reincarnation, and what have you.
Yeah. And then probably the most obvious one is the chapter name, the Book of Going Forth, is the original Egyptian name for the Book of the Dead. It's translated as the Book of Going Forth by Day. Or the Book of Coming Forth by Day, or Utterances of Going Forth by Day, because it's quite hard to literally translate 5,000 years of what's it.
Because book two, which we will talk about next week, is the Book of the Dead. Right. Do you have an obscure reference, Finial, for me, Francine?
Yeah, I do. One of the characters, the lovely curly-headed little boy, is called Arthur Ludorum. And his father was one of the assassins. And
Scholarship boy,
yes. Victor Ludorum, or Victrix Ludorum, is Latin for the winner of the games. Still kind of used in posho sports now, but it initially was last man standing in Roman gladiator tournaments. So,
I like that. It's a good obscure reference.
And I think in either in one of the other proper books or in the Assassin's Guild diary, which I don't have a copy of, Victor Ludorum is written in one of the ledgers.
So
it seems like Ludorum is like an old assassin's name, which makes sense.
Oh, that's nice.
I couldn't find whether Johann was in any way relevant.
I started, and
then there were Swedish kings, and I stopped before I could go down any of that rabbit hole.
Yeah, there's a Swedish monarchy rabbit hole on a Thursday.
Exactly. Not for internal use.
I think that's everything for this section.
I think it had better be. What have I got here? Oh, that says for next week, so I'll talk about that next week. I had to make a whole other section because I kept coming across really cool little bits where I'm like, no, that's more relevant for next week.
Yeah, that was part of the logic of splitting this up the way I did, hopefully, yeah. Maybe. Yeah, so next week we are going to talk about book two, The Book of the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be hanging out in jail. Jelly baby.
Well, jail. We're very sorry for this episode, listeners. We tried.
We're meant to be cutting down on apologising. I'm so sorry for the amount we've apologised, dear listeners.
You're meant to be cutting down on apologising. I don't apologise nearly enough, so you know it comes genuinely right. From me. I'm very sorry, listeners. But I think you'll understand why we're quite low energy this week.
Until next week, dear listeners, when we discuss The Book of the Dead, you can follow us on Instagram at The Truth Shall Make You Fret, on Twitter at Make You Fret Pod. You can follow us, or you can find our Facebook page at The Truth Shall Make You Fret. We might even return with some Wednesday headcanons, which have died down for a few weeks for varying circumstances, including my plague.
Joe got ill and then everything was awful, so.
Yeah. You can email us your thoughts, queries, castles, snacks, and albatrosses. The truth shall make ye fretpod at gmail.com, especially entomologists listeners. We hope there are at least one of you.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah, if you're an entomologist, let us know. Tell us about beetles. We just want fun beetle facts.
Ask questions and we'll try and give you answers.
Oh, Francine. Francine. And until next time, dear listener, don't let us detain you.
I don't think we could if we tried.
Oh, we need to stop insulting our own podcast on our podcast. Save that for Twitter.
Oh, self-deprecation is our generation's...
Did I tell you about my stupid apology moment the other day?
No.
You know, I was talking about how someone was trying to take blood and struggling to the point where this elbow was a mess for a couple of days. It looks better now.
Yeah.
I actually apologise for my blood not coming out fast enough. I literally apologised for my own veins.
Well, you know, if you had better moral standing, your blood would flow like justice. As it is sluggish with your sin.
Yeah, I literally apologise for my own blood, so I might need to cut down slightly.
Yeah,
well, sorry about that.
We'll get therapy when we can go outside again.